Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. A researcher and her team mapped more than 150 miles of fence near Cody.
The extent of fences on the landscape and the complete lack of information that we have about them have been really stunning to me.
When Diana Foster Green first started studying women who received and were denied abortions in the mid-2000s, there wasn't much research on it.
So it really was time to not just assume and to actually collect rigorous data.
There's a relatively small active Jewish community in the state, and while one rabbi says he's seen anti-Semitism rise since the October 7th, 2023 attacks in Israel, he says he still feels welcomed. Those stories and more. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. President Trump has backed away from some of the sweeping tariffs for goods coming from overseas, but companies are still facing turbulence. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports, business leaders in the outdoor industry are concerned.
In Boulder, Colorado, with the foothills in the distance, lies a warehouse filled with rows and rows of shoes.
Rock climbing shoes, mountaineering boots, trail running shoes, hiking boots, and approach shoes.
This is storage for La Sportiva. It's a company based in the Italian Alps that makes shoes for mountain sports. And this is its North American headquarters. Jonathan Lance is in charge of this region of the business. He says the shoes come from all over the world.
Italy, Romania, China, Vietnam.
La Sportiva is sending all these shoes here because it's at the heart of the country's big outdoors industry. Americans like to get out and hike, climb, ski, fish. 3 out of 5 recreate outdoors, and it's a $1 trillion chunk of the economy, especially important to the Mountain West.
The U.S. is a very strong market for pretty much every brand in the outdoor industry. And we have a lot of opportunity for growth.
But he says it's not clear what the U.S. market will look like going forward. The last few weeks have been rocky. President Trump has unleashed a trade war with much of the world. He abruptly paused some of the highest tariffs for 90 days pending talks, but he kept others in place and raised them dramatically for China in what's become an escalating tariff battle between the economic superpowers. That means it's more expensive for Lance to bring shoes to the U.S. to sell here.
You can't absorb that. You can't sell a product to a retailer like REI and lose money.
So he says he'll probably need to raise prices for consumers. Lance guessed that a $100 pair of shoes could cost as much as $180. That was with the higher, now paused tariffs.
It's a constant juggle.
The stop-and-go nature of tariff decisions is also making business planning hard for Travis Campbell. He's the CEO of adventure travel company Eagle Creek.
Don't get me wrong, I'm happy to have the 90 days, but it actually doesn't change anything because we don't know what's on the other side of those 90 days.
Eagle Creek is based in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Campbell says the company already pays a tax to bring bags and other gear into the country from its factory in Indonesia. When President Trump first imposed tariffs, it was facing an additional 32% fee.
We paused salary increases. We paused hiring people.
Then came Trump's moratorium. But he kept a new 10% tariff for all countries.
I want more than anything to be able to push through the salary increases that we had planned for people. And we had a big discussion around, like, does the 90-day pause give us confidence to push through those increases? And it doesn't.
The Trump administration says these policies will entice manufacturing back to the U.S. Mallory Odoranio does manufacture here. Her outdoor women's apparel brand called Ewer is based in Missoula, Montana. The clothes are made in a Los Angeles factory.
It allows us to have a really fun and vibrant product assortment without committing to thousands and thousands of units of each style.
So she says she's a bit more insulated, except some of her fabric comes from China.
There's not a huge textile industry in the United States.
She's pivoted to buy some fabrics from other countries. Now she feels like she's done what she can.
The main question is, how is this going to impact the economy and then people's ability to have discretionary income to buy things from us?
Outdoor business leaders are heading to D.C. at the end of the month to meet with members of Congress. One thing's for certain, tariffs will be on the agenda. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
A study found that each year, one ungulate dies from getting caught up in fence line for every 2.5 miles of fence. There's been a push recently to remove or replace fences to allow deer, pronghorn, and elk to move about and migrate. But one of the biggest hurdles is knowing where all those miles and miles of fence actually are. Kristen Barker is part of a team that mapped more than 150 miles of fence on public lands east of Yellowstone near Cody. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats spoke with her about how she hopes the map will be used to help wildlife while also balancing the needs of working cattle lands.
As someone who's newer in the fence ecology world, I did not realize how many fences there are on the landscape. It is just mind-blowing how many miles of fences there are. And then I also didn't understand that nobody has any idea where they are or what conditions they're in. There have been a couple of studies trying to look at fences, and it's hard because we don't have the information, but there have been some conservative estimates of, I think, over 150,000 miles of fences just in elk wintering habitat in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. There's been a colored pronghorn that was noted navigating 250 fence lines in a single year. So they're really pervasive across the landscape. And there are a lot of groups working to make sure those fences are safe for wildlife, but we just really don't have all the information.
Why is all this fence here? When and why was it installed? What kind of fence are we talking about? And do we know anything about, like, whether the ratio of used to unused fence?
I can't speak to the ratio of used to unused. I can say that fences have been out on the landscape for over 100 years. There was they call it the barbed wire boom of the late 1800s, kind of around the 1880s, when the use of barbed wire fence just exploded throughout the West. And so fences really started going up in earnest then. And of course, they've, you know, continued to be built and put out on the landscape since then. There are definitely fences that were built a long time ago that aren't needed anymore. And it's helpful to get those off the landscape. And then there are also fences that are old and kind of not in great shape, but they are still being used. And those are actually extra important to try to deal with, because it's when especially when the top wire gets really loose, or when the top two wires get loose, is when it's really easy for animals to get snagged when they're trying to jump over the fence. So the older fences that are in kind of rough condition are actually quite hazardous when wildlife are trying to cross them.
I know you were working with a crew that was helping you help map the fences. Did you encounter any wildlife that was caught in a fence, trying to cross the fence, or anything like that?
The crew found 5 wildlife mortalities that were definitively caused by fences. So animals that got tangled up in fences and died there. And we were very conservative on what we considered a mortality. So there were some other, you know, pieces of animals and dead things that were likely attributable to fences, but 5 of them were very clearly just killed by the fence itself.
What did the field crew find in terms of the condition of some of these fences, the height of some of these fences, and how will that information be used to potentially modify fences in the area in the future?
They found a range of fences from following very wildlife-friendly specifications to less so. For instance, there is a really long drop fence, which is very cool. So the game and fish can drop the entire fence down onto the ground during wildlife migration time so the animals can pass through. So that's an example of a fence that they found that's really great for wildlife. Anything under about 38 inches high is decent for animals to jump over. And then the bottom wires are what's important for pronghorn because they typically scoot under fences instead of jumping over them. So you want the bottom wire to be like 16 to 18 inches above the ground. And so they found a range of fences, some that were built to those specifications, but most fences historically haven't been built to those specifications because we only learned those numbers recently. And so one of the things that the data are being used for right now is an effort by AFI to...
Absorca Fence Initiative.
Yes, sorry. An effort by the Absorca Fence Initiative to do some range-wide improvements, specifically targeting the Carter Mountain pronghorn herd. Pronghorn just have a harder time crossing fences, and they're really susceptible to other things like deep snow. And so just trying to make sure that habitat is as easy for pronghorn to move through as possible is really important moving forward. And so AFI is using the data we've collected to identify fences that could be modified so that it's easier for pronghorn to cross them.
Some of what you were doing out in the field as you were looking at where the fences are located is that you were cleaning up prior data on where the fences were located. What did you do there in terms of updating what's out there for mapping?
Essentially, the field crews would walk the boundaries of all of the grazing allotments and pastures on the Forest Service. And if those were not surrounded by a fence, then they would remove that from the existing database that we had pulled together.
Has there been any fences that have been modified or removed at this stage? Tell us what the next phase of the project is going to look like.
AFI is currently working on the modification and removal end. So that's sort of their expertise, is doing physical fence work. And then we are continuing our fence mapping project to inform current and future work. So as they are, developing plans and modifying fences that we've already mapped, we're going to continue mapping more. And so because they've now identified, based on our first season of work, they've identified the Carter Mountain pronghorn herd range as a really particularly good focal point for them to start on. And so we are supporting that work by also focusing on that range for our next phase of work. So this summer, we're going to do what we can to map all of the fences across the entire range of the Carter Mountain pronghorn.
Is there anything else that I should have asked? Anything else that you want to highlight or that the public should know at this juncture?
I would love it if people knew that, the places where folks are, running cows and need fences are, those fences are still really important, and we're glad they're there. And there are also ways that you can still retain livestock just as effectively and make it easy for other wildlife to cross the fence. And there are a lot of cost share programs, for instance, through the NRCS, where you can actually get money to, repair your fences. So if there's a fence line that, you want to replace anyway, you could go for cost share to replace it, and it would be, you could have it replaced to wildlife friendly specifications. So it's kind of a win-win.
That was Kristen Barker talking about Beyond Yellowstone Living Lab's efforts to map fence lines, speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats. While Wyoming is no longer investing in cloud seeding, some other states in our region are. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Water managers around the region have been using cloud seeding to help with drought mitigation along the Colorado River Basin. While Wyoming lawmakers just decided not to fund the state's program this year, others along the river are calling for it to be used more. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Alex Hager visited the biggest cloud seeding program in the nation to see how it works.
It's an overcast day in the foothills north of Salt Lake City. Jared Smith crunches through spring snow toward a white trailer about the size of a dumpster. It's got a few antennas and metal poles sticking out of the top. Smith works for North American Weather Consultants, which operates about 200 of these across Utah.
Really, anywhere there's a mountain range that's going to be producing water, we're going to be trying to target it.
This machine shoots particles of silver iodide into passing clouds and makes them drop their snow, enough to boost the state's water supply by more than 10% some years.
Good to turn it on.
As futuristic as it might sound, this technology isn't new. In fact, it's looked pretty much the same since the 1950s. What is new is that it can be turned on from far away.
And so now, instead of having some guy walk out here in a snowstorm and hit a switch, one of your guys can do this from the office, from home?
From their bed, yeah, anywhere, their phone, yeah.
Utah is not only making this equipment more precise and efficient, it's also spending. Its cloud seeding program uses $5 million every year, much more than most of its neighbors. Jonathan Jennings runs the state's cloud seeding program.
If you're able to continue to live in the state of Utah without any worry about water, that's part of the cloud seeding program helping.
Jennings says Utah's program is special because it's using cutting-edge tech like those remote-operated setups and drones that can get much closer to the clouds. He says the amount of water Utah can add through that work will help set a precedent for what's possible elsewhere.
Everybody not only has eyes on Utah, but they support what we're doing in hopes that we are widely successful to the point where their states are going to be forced to fund cloud seeding even more.
And funding is already coming in from some faraway places. The Maine Water Agency in Las Vegas, they sent $800,000 to Utah's program because mountain snowmelt is the single most important source of water for the Colorado River. That matters even to cities in the desert. Colby Pellegrino is with the Southern Nevada Water Authority.
That is what fills the Colorado River and what fills the reservoir where we get 90% of our supply.
Elsewhere in the arid West, there are calls to make programs in more states look like Utah's. Andrew Rickert runs cloud seeding in Colorado.
Let's put some real science and money behind this and show people that we can increase our water in a safe and efficient manner.
And there's a good chance we will start to see more cloud seeding around the West because there's also investment coming from the private sector. Augustus DiRico runs Rainmaker, a startup that just bought the main cloud seeding operator in Utah, and he has big plans to expand.
As Utah becomes more of a success story, which we're excited to play a role in, I think it'll only be natural that other states become much more interested as well.
But at the same time, some people involved in cloud seeding are facing a lot of hate. Conspiracy theorists falsely accused Utah's Jonathan Jennings of spraying toxic chemicals in the air and went after him personally.
They were death threats. Most of it was general harassment, but there were death threats and threat of doxing as well. In fact, they were successful.
For the record, scientific studies have proven cloud seeding to be completely safe time and time again. And the harassment isn't stopping Jennings.
It's not whether or not I believe in it. It simply works. There's no discussion anymore as to whether or not it works. We have to answer how much it works.
And as Jennings is on his way to finding that out with old science and new technology, he knows other states will be watching closely. I'm Alex Hager.
The Wyoming Supreme Court is currently considering the legality of banning most abortions. This issue has been considered by the courts nationally for decades. In 2007, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy speculated that women can be depressed after getting an abortion and regret their decision, but said there was no reliable data to prove this. That perked Diana Green Foster's ears, so the University of California professor decided to find out. How does women's mental, physical, and financial health fare if they get an abortion versus getting turned away? The result is Foster's 10-year-long turnaway study following over 1,000 women. She shared her findings with Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach on a recent trip to the Equality State.
How did you actually go about this study?
So the idea for the study was sparked when an abortion doctor said to me, she wonders what happens to the people they turn away. And I hadn't realized that clinics regularly turn people away. Clinics sometimes turn people away for health conditions, maybe not being able to pay for the abortion. They also sometimes turn people away because they're a little bit too far along in pregnancy. We had two groups of people that were very similar at the beginning, but one group got that abortion and one group didn't. And even more than that, because we recruited at so many sites across America, we ended up recruiting some people who got an abortion at the same exact point in pregnancy where someone else would have been denied an abortion in a different state.
So tell me about what you found.
So on the main question of whether abortion hurts people's mental health, we don't find evidence of that. In fact, we found worse mental health among people who are denied abortions. And that means a short period of anxiety, lower self-esteem. Over time, the two groups look the same in terms of mental health. Not because both groups are doing badly. In fact, both groups improve over time. It's not really a mental health story. And that's sort of consistent with when you ask people why they want an abortion. They have so many reasons. Usually it's money, ability to take care of their existing kids, the quality of the relationship with the person they became pregnant with, their other life goals and responsibilities. And it's in all those other areas that we see the big differences. And on many indicators, the two groups look the same, but if they vary, it's always to the detriment of people who are denied. Your physical health is worse because of complications from the delivery, but also for years later. Your economic stability and well-being is worse. And not only do they suffer, but their kids suffer. More than half of people who get abortions are already parenting. It's not uncommon for someone who's parenting who wants an abortion to say that their reason is to take care of the kids they already have. And sure enough, we see that existing kids are more likely to live in poverty, less likely to hit developmental milestones if their mom couldn't get that abortion.
I'm curious how you've seen your research be used. I imagine it's being referenced in a lot of these court hearings and different cases making their way around the United States. And, you know, I've heard that it's being used by both sides.
The most famous statistic from the study is that more than 95% of people who get their abortions say they made the right decision. And what the people who are opposed to abortion like from the study is that it's also true that the people who were turned away, most of them eventually say they were glad they were turned away. So what's surprising about that is that the people who are denied abortions seem like they're faring worse. They have worse physical health, worse financial well-being. Their kids are doing worse. Their relationships are not as good. But you never know the path you didn't take is one thing. It's also hard to tell anyone that you wish you hadn't had your child.
How has the research impacted your own stance on abortion rights?
I think my stance is very evidence-based. I thought the people who are denied abortions would be depressed, and that's not what the data show. And I'm very happy to report exactly what the data show. And I didn't have a huge agenda. I was more interested in providing some data so we don't always make these decisions knee-jerk or based on ideology, that we can actually listen to the people who are affected, see what their outcomes are, and make decisions that hopefully improve everybody's well-being.
I want to switch gears a little bit. I was at the recent Wyoming Supreme Court hearing. It was the first time justices considered Wyoming's abortion case. They're trying to determine the constitutionality of two near total abortion bans. And, you know, I was talking to a couple attendees there. Some people who were on the more anti-abortion side were saying, you know, if you don't want a baby, it's your responsibility to prevent that from happening. What do you say to those kinds of arguments?
Two-thirds of the people in my study became pregnant when they were using contraception. The other third of people who weren't using a contraceptive method, I think that it's actually not that easy to consistently use a method. I also have sympathy for people who couldn't access contraception or didn't think they were at risk, they weren't planning on having sex, some people are raped. Pregnancy is not something that we need to blame people for. It happens. It happens despite folks' intentions. And it also sometimes happens that people want abortions when they intended to become pregnant because their circumstances change, because they get some new information like a diagnosis. So this is not just so simple like, oh, people should prevent pregnancy.
Some of the justices were very focused on this discussion of when life begins. The state holds that life begins at conception. You know, the plaintiffs who are suing the state are saying that is a religious viewpoint. Some of the justices were saying, I don't know if that's religious. Isn't this rooted in some kind of secular ideology? Is there science that backs that up?
I don't know that this is a question science can answer. I certainly don't have anything beyond my own personal viewpoint on this. And everyone's viewpoint seems to be, you know, a product of how they were raised and their religion and their circumstances, and maybe not something that is easy for the government to decide for everybody.
What should listeners, especially in a rural state like Wyoming, be thinking about?
The crisis of maternity care in this state is huge, where there's just an insufficient number of doctors. This is not a good context for people to carry pregnancies to term if they don't have good access to health care. People vastly underestimate the risks of pregnancy. We had two women from the study die within days of childbirth, both from common causes of maternal death. We had no deaths among the people who had abortions. And the health risks didn't end there. We actually saw worse health for years later among the people who'd given birth.
You finished conducting your study a couple years ago. What's next for you in terms of research?
So I have a study of the consequences of the end of a federal guarantee of abortion rights. And that study has 1,800 people in it. They're all from states with bans. And I thought it was going to be another turnaway study. But in fact, the vast majority of people get their abortions anyway. They just do it with great delay and great expense. The fraction of people who needed second trimester abortions went from 8% to 17% because they had to travel hundreds of miles because they had to take time to raise money or gather resources. So they may be getting their abortions, but they're getting them later. I'm sure that wasn't the intended effect of banning abortion. It's why we do actually need to study these things, because, you know, you can't assume that passing a ban means no one ever gets an abortion again. Instead, it changes how they get them and the experience. And we need to know what is that effect.
That was Diana Green Foster, who is a University of California professor. She led the Turnaway study, which followed over 1,000 women who both received and were denied abortions. As a part of rural Colorado discusses nuclear waste storage, mistrust bubbles up. This is Open Spaces.
Season 10 of The Modern West is called The Gray in Between. Episode 1 starts us off with a conversation with economist Samuel Western about how the West got so darn black and white.
We've always had a thing against the federal government, but the late 70s and 80s really stuck in people's craw, and it didn't go away.
A pluralistic mindset. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by the Equality State Policy Center.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. Wyoming's legislature will consider storing spent nuclear fuel during this year's interim session. Communities just south of Wyoming's borders are already discussing importing radioactive waste, but some are raising concerns there. The Mountain West News Bureau's Scott Franz examines the risk, starting at a Superfund site in southern Colorado.
3 years ago, the Department of Energy asked for feedback on its national search for a place to temporarily store the waste piling up at power plants. The results showed many didn't trust the government to safely handle it. Like Jerry Fry, who lives in Canyon City near the remains of an old uranium mill.
We're living with an active Superfund site that hasn't been cleaned up since it was declared. And so it's more than 40 years now.
Jerry Fry grew up near this mill, which processed uranium to feed nuclear reactors. Now, Fry and her group, Colorado Citizens Against Toxic Waste, are among the hundreds weighing in on what the federal government aims to do with the waste that comes out of nuclear power plants. Today, she's taking me on a tour of the contaminated area. It's down a lonely gravel road. Kind of spooky here.
Yeah.
We come to a stop at an empty guard shack.
This fence is the restricted area, so you can't go beyond that, but there aren't any signs on it.
Behind this fence, high above us, are the remains of the Cotter Uranium Mill. More than 5 million tons of radioactive waste is buried up there. Fry's community is still dealing with the fallout of radioactive contamination from decades ago. The waste leached into groundwater and migrated to residential areas. And while Fry isn't from northwest Colorado, she wants communities to understand the full picture of risks, as a group in that area shops around the idea of importing nuclear waste.
These things have half-lives that are centuries, millennia long. And so a community that is not given full disclosure and full information about what they're signing on to could just get a horrible commitment.
Fry is an activist, not a nuclear scientist. So we consulted with experts on this question. How safe is the stuff coming out of reactors today?
Growing up right after major accidents like Three Mile Island, followed by Chernobyl, really sparked my interest in nuclear power, nuclear safety.
Anna Erickson is a professor of nuclear engineering at Georgia Tech University, and she leads a research consortium sponsored by the National Nuclear Security Administration.
It was done very carelessly in the past. It is not how we do things today. We have a lot better understanding of material associated with uranium fuel cycle. And we do not think that depleted uranium is harmless anymore, right?
Erickson says the scale of today's waste from power plants is more manageable than the waste from nuclear weapons and fuel production in places like Canyon City, where Jerry Fry lives.
But if you take all of the spent fuel that's been stored on site of nuclear reactors and you consolidate it all, it's size of about a football field, right? About 10 yards deep.
Today's waste, called spent fuel, is stored in large cylinders made of concrete and steel. The material inside is dangerous, Erickson says.
Once the fuel is stored in those casks, the radiation around those casks is actually not that high. Those casks are regularly inspected today by humans with those Geiger counters that you've seen or other instruments. But in the future, we're looking to move to robotics inspection.
And Erickson says the nation has not had any major accidents with spent fuel. But some scientists are worried it won't stay that way. Edwin Lyman is also a nuclear waste expert. He's the director of nuclear power safety at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C.
And if there's no long-term plan to transfer that spent fuel to a more durable structure that can last for geologic time, then we can have a problem.
The idea being floated in northwest Colorado is for a facility that would temporarily house waste being created at power plants around the country. Lyman says without a plan for permanent storage, communities could get stuck with waste that must be protected for generations.
So that's the real challenge of nuclear waste disposal, is finding a way to make sure that it doesn't affect the environment over this very long time period that it will remain toxic.
Lyman also points to mishaps. In 2018, workers moving a canister of spent fuel in California made an error and almost dropped it down onto the floor of a concrete bunker. Lyman called it a near miss. He has other concerns, like transportation accidents, sabotage, and terrorism.
A deliberate attack is certainly one way where you could maximize the potential harm to the community from that facility.
Back in Canyon City, community meetings about cleaning up the old Cotter Superfund site have been happening as recently as this month. Jerry Fry has been keeping tabs.
It's been filthy and uncleaned up for 40 years. And it probably will not be cleaned up by the time I'm gone.
But Fry is also looking toward the future. That's why she regularly writes letters and comments on the nation's plans for nuclear energy. After she tuned into some of the storage discussions happening in Northwest Colorado, she was sad.
Because it's the same old game. And it's very opportunistic.
She says any community considering raising its hand should be asking lots of questions.
If, as a community, we're going to have to host this, how long is that going on? The containers that this material's in, are the containers going to last the life of the contents?
And those opportunities to ask questions will come soon. Public meetings on the waste storage idea are being planned in Northwest Colorado, and the Department of Energy says it will formally ask which communities are interested in the idea this fall. I'm Scott Franz in Canyon City.
A new report found a high jump in anti-Semitic incidents in the state. A leader of Wyoming's Jewish community speaks with us. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1, on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Wyoming only has about 2,000 practicing Jews, and according to the Anti-Defamation League, the number of reports of anti-Semitic incidents in the state has jumped nearly 42% from 2023 to 2024. Wyoming Public Radio's Corwin Schlump spoke with Chabad Rabbi Zalman Mendelson about the experience of being Jewish in the state. Mendelson opened the Jewish Community Center in Jackson in 2007 when he moved to the state from Miami.
At that time, there were approximately 500 Jewish people who lived in Jackson, many of whom were requesting a full-time rabbi. At that time, when I moved, there wasn't a full-time rabbi in the state of Wyoming.
So there's free rabbis in Wyoming today?
Right now, there are three. I believe we're on our way down to two. We have intentions of opening up more Chabad Jewish community centers in Wyoming. So we expect to have more Jewish leadership in the state of Wyoming.
And what's the philosophy behind the Chabad Lubavitch? Like, what's the history of them?
Great question. So Chabad is about 250 years old. It was started by Rabbi Schneir Zalman of Liadi. It started in White Russia. Chabad is an acronym for three Hebrew words, Chachma, Bina, and Das, which means wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And the idea is to not just have an experiential Judaism or an emotional Judaism or a social Judaism or a cultural Judaism, but to have an intellectual one where you understand and debate and deeply integrate the ideas and the wisdom and the values of Judaism in an intellectual capacity. There are now some 5,000 Chabad Jewish centers around the world in over 100 countries and all 50 states. And each of them operate under the same philosophy of creating a space of intellectual Jewish rigor and ideas and values based on the wisdom of the Torah, 4,000-year-old tradition, and a space where love and inclusivity and friendship are of paramount importance.
Are you open to non-Jews coming?
Absolutely. Many of our programs are open to the broader community. We have Hanukkah events annually that receive many, many people from outside of the Jewish community that participate. We encourage that, but we don't proselytize. So we are not focused on converting non-Jewish people to become Jews. We're focused on bringing Jewish education and celebration and values to Jewish people who are thirsty for more Jewish opportunities and learning.
And what's the Jewish experience in life like in Wyoming in general, or at least in your experience?
Yeah, it's been living up to its namesake. The Equality State is real for the Jewish community in Wyoming. The community has welcomed us over the last almost 18 years with open arms. So we've seen an incredible outpour of love and support for the Jewish people, particularly after October 7th. I travel around the state extensively for performing bar and bat mitzvahs and Jewish weddings and unfortunately funerals at times. And so I see people from every walk of life in every nook and cranny around the state. One of the things that we have a very good sense of are the hearts and kindness of the people of the state of Wyoming, the most welcoming, kind, and loving people who've embraced us with open arms. We watched all of the outrageous support for Hamas come up on campuses around the world and people chanting all kinds of genocidal remarks against Jewish people all across the country. And we were terribly disturbed around the world. But in Wyoming, we witnessed something very different. Thousands upon thousands of people writing, "Wyoming stands with Jews, Wyoming stands with Israel," and sending us letters and walking to our home and to our place of worship and putting out flowers and putting out chocolates and letting us know that they stand with us. The heartwarming response that we experienced was just enormously cathartic and loving and gave us the courage and the strength to continue doing the work that we do.
Have you ever experienced anti-Semitism in Wyoming?
Yes, I have. Several years back, I remember that April very clearly. It was very disturbing when I was called by a member of our community that somebody had spray-painted swastikas on the signs of the entrance of a state park. But the police right away took notice of it, and they promised that they would investigate, and they did. Recently, there was a bullet hole that we found in the synagogue in Cheyenne. We haven't yet been able to identify what the cause was. It's very worrisome for us. We don't know if it was a mistake or an accidental discharge or an act of hatred, but we do want to get to the bottom of these things. We will not at any point in time cower in fear. We will stand tall and proud of our tradition, and we know that the vast majority of the people in the state of Wyoming accept us, but unfortunately, every so often there are people who act with hatred.
Has the Wyoming government done anything to support the Jewish community in fighting anti-Semitism?
So there have been quite a few expressions from leadership in the state of Wyoming. I don't know how long you've been here, but I've been through three governors in the time that I've been here, and every single one of them have stood together with the Jewish community on Hanukkah. We do an annual menorah lighting and Hanukkah party in the state capitol building. And as you know, Governor Friedenthal was a Democrat. Governor Mead, a Republican, Governor Gordon, a Republican, and it's something unique where we have Christians and Jews and people from all walks of life and different religions and different lifestyles coming together in support of the Jewish community every year on Hanukkah.
What's the interfaith relationships like in Wyoming?
There are several Muslims that live in Jackson that I have a wonderful relationship with. It's very important for me to develop authentic, loving, neighborly relations with all human beings. Sometimes it's difficult to speak about subjects related to the war in Gaza, related to the war in Lebanon, related to the challenges with the Houthis and the challenges of what's going on in Syria and Iran. Not always is it a comfortable conversation, but we have those conversations too. We do it from a place of respect and love. We do have relationships with others that are from Middle Eastern background but aren't Muslim. There's a great friend of ours who's a Lebanese Christian who lives in Jackson. And we have relationships with Iranians or Persians that live here in the community, relationships with people from others from Lebanese background. And so we cherish those relationships. Every month we gather in the town square in Jackson in support of Israel and calling on leadership to do whatever they can to release the hostages. And we have so many the Christian leaders that join us in that effort and members of the Christian community who stand together with us. And we are deeply grateful for that cooperation and that special relationship that we have.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was Chabad Rabbi Zalman Mendelson speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Corin Schlump about the experience of being Jewish in Wyoming. When you think of a natural history museum, you probably picture dinosaur skeletons or fossils. But behind the scenes, museums hold lots more preserved plants and animals called specimens. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports on one project in our region that's part of a larger effort to make specimens more accessible for science.
In a room behind a scientific laboratory at the University of Colorado Boulder are rows and rows of tall gray cabinets. Adrian Carper opens one of the metal doors and pulls out a wooden tray with a glass lid. Inside are dead bees, lots of them, each one suspended in space under a tiny metal pin.
Probably 200 to 300 specimens, all with varying shades of yellow or sepia-toned paper, with some handwritten labels, some typed labels.
There are fuzzy bumblebees, the size of pennies, metallic blue and green bees, the common leafcutter bee.
Megachile melanophia. You can see that it was collected from the Science Lodge, West Boulder, Colorado, June 21st, 1940, by Ann Lutz.
Several Mountain West states are home to some of the highest levels of bee diversity in the country, but many wild bees are in decline because of increased development, pesticide use, and climate change. Obviously, scientists can't count each and every winged insect in the wild to measure those declines.
What's the biggest source of our data? It's right here in our natural history collections and on those pens.
Studying these bees could answer questions like, are certain species buzzing in the same places they once were? Have their bodies changed over time? But unless you're here digging through these cabinets, you can't access this data or analyze it to uncover patterns. That's why Carper's working on a project to digitize these bee collections and more with researchers on other campuses like the University of Nevada, Reno and Arizona State University.
So if we get that data and we can rebuild those distributions, we can look to see how they're changing through time, which could inform something so basic as whether or not we should even be concerned that they're declining.
His team took pictures of the bees and their accompanying tags, and now they're relying on volunteers to type up all that info. Maggie Jacobs is one of the dedicated volunteers. From her house in San Francisco, she logs onto a web platform called Notes from Nature.
Let's do the mining bees. I love the mining bees.
Up pops a zoomed-in photo of a bee from Carper's collection in Boulder. She types out the coordinates where this bee was found. Sometimes it's written in hard-to-read cursive.
I think that's probably an N.
Jacobs is a retired software engineer, not a biologist, but she feels her transcriptions are contributing to science.
So if someone says, for instance, I want to research the bees from Larimer County, they can find it now.
Volunteers have transcribed about 80,000 bee records so far, but there's lots more work to do. Across the globe, there are about 1 billion specimens, plants, mammals, fish, in drawers and jars, tucked away in museum backrooms. They include bugs from a rainforest that no longer exists, and birds now extinct. But most have no digital footprint.
We've only fairly recently started developing technologies that make that easier.
Natalie Cooper is a researcher at the Natural History Museum in London. She says many museums are working to change this. They're collecting DNA from their specimens and taking 3D scans. She says it's happening now because scientists are racing to better understand the effects of biodiversity loss and climate change.
There's so many things all coming together that are threatening the planet that we really need to have that data available for people to work with.
She says the more objects we're able to digitize, the more scientists can be working to find answers about the past and the future. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, our audio producer, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.